Well, it's for me a pleasure to introduce you, John Bartle, senior lecturer at the University of Essex. John is an expert in two rather different fields. One is British electoral behavior, which we are not going to deal with today. But he's also very interested and an expert in the British judiciary. He's now going to speak to us on the new Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. Thank you.
Thanks, Augusti. Yes, as Augusti has explained, my chief research interests lie in the field of public opinion. But I do have a recurring interest in the judiciary. This is for one simple reason. After Augusti and I met at the University of Essex in 1989, I went off to train as an English solicitor. And after 4 years training as an English solicitor and qualifying, I decided I didn't like being a lawyer, and I went back to political science. But I've retained this interest in the operation of the courts and the judiciary in Britain. Some caveats about what I'm going to say today. This presentation is not really the result of any in-depth or systematic research. It's not even work in progress. Over the last few years, I've continued to have a watching brief over developments in the courts and the judiciary in Britain, but I've not really researched it in great depth. So it's a very welcome opportunity to talk about this issue because it helps me think about research. The other thing to observe is that very few political scientists in Britain are actually interested in what is happening in the courts. You look around amongst all the departments of government, very few people are studying what's happening in the judiciary. And also, I think there's another thing to observe, which is traditional approaches to studying the courts, such as you see in the United States, are problematic in the British case for quite a few reasons. Counting cases, which is what we do when we tend to quantify and make things political science, would be thoroughly misleading in this case because some of the cases are of much greater constitutional importance than others. So the old-fashioned style of just simply observing what's happening in the courts and then trying to make sense of it actually makes much more sense in relation to the operation of the British courts. Just to give you a preamble to show you where we're going. Before 2008, the highest court in the UK was known as the House of Lords, which caused a lot of confusion, because the House of Lords was also the name of the upper chamber of Parliament, an upper chamber which was composed largely of hereditary peers who sat there simply because they were born into the right family. But the House of Lords, the highest court, was in fact a select committee of that upper chamber of Parliament. That House of Lords was also reputed to have very little influence over policy. Nobody bothered in political science to study the House of Lords because it was thought to have very little power. The Constitutional Reform Act of 2005 created a new institution with the very grand title, the Supreme Court. It raises certain expectations about the power and authority of this institution. But the new Supreme Court is really just the old House of Lords, the Appellate Committee of the House of Lords, sitting in a different building. So that might be disappointing. Why bother talking about this institution? So it's not really new. It's really the old House of Lords, the Appellate Committee, sitting as a different institution, old wine in new bottles. It's not really supreme in the United States sense of a Supreme Court. It's supreme in relation to the other UK courts only. It's the highest court in the UK. But parliamentary sovereignty, the idea that Parliament can do anything it likes, is still the guiding, if not the only principle of the British Constitution. So I've set this up. I said, there's a new institution. It's called the Supreme Court. But it's not really new, and it's not really supreme. And by reputation, the old House of Lords wasn't terribly interesting. So why bother talking about it? The reason to talk about this institution is simple. The popular understanding of the House of Lords, the court that this replaced, as weak and unpowerful, was simply wrong. The House of Lords had grown significant power over time. And the House of Lords and the courts in general have become significant political actors in the British political system. They're actors that no government, no civil servant, no legislator can afford to ignore. So go back to the British tradition. Our traditional understanding of the British Constitution was set out by the writer A.V. Dicey, Arthur Venn Dicey. And he said the British Constitution was really, really simple. It rested on two pillars, two fundamental pillars of the Constitution. Parliamentary sovereignty. Parliament is omnipotent. To use an example that has been used, Parliament could legislate to stop Frenchmen smoking in the streets of Paris, and that would be good English law. Or, and I'll make this problematic and make a link later, the British Parliament could legislate to stop Spanish fishermen registering their fishing boats as UK fishing boats. It could do that. It could do anything it darn well wanted. The second pillar of the Constitution was the rule of law, the idea that the courts simply enforced the law subject to the principle of parliamentary sovereignty. The courts have never, ever had a power to overturn an act of Parliament. There's no Marbury versus Madison power that such as you see in the United States Constitution. Courts cannot declare acts of Parliament unconstitutional. And historically, there was no tension between these two principles. Judges in the UK had never been central actors as they have been in the US. Indeed, most books on British government and even the British Constitution routinely ignored the courts. When I was studying politics at Mexborough School in South Yorkshire in 1984, we used a book by Harvey and Bather. Harvey and Bather were lecturers at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And they had one 12-page chapter on the courts. That 12-page chapter on the courts merely described the structure of the courts, the hierarchy of courts, the doctrine of precedent. They didn't think it was interesting to speculate about the power that the judiciary had at all. So the House of Lords, which was also the name of the upper house or second chamber, should really have been called the Appellate Committee of the House of Lords. It's a very odd situation. They were members of the legislature. The senior judges were members of the legislature. They could sit in debates in Parliament. They could vote. Some of them were active participants discussing and debating legislation. Some of them chose not to, but it was very much left up to them. They gave their judgments in the upper house. A very famous case in the early part of the 21st century was the Pinochet case, which was an amazing judgment. Pinochet had been arrested on a bench warrant issued by a man named Bartle, no relation to me, I'm afraid. He was issued a bench warrant for the arrest of Pinochet, who was being treated at a hospital in London. And Pinochet asserted that he had immunity granted to him by the Chilean Parliament, and the case went before the House of Lords. And it was televised. They sat up in the House of Lords chamber, in the red benches, when it was empty, when there were no debates, and they gave their judgments. The first two judges declared that Pinochet had immunity. Then the third judge stood up and said that he had no immunity at all. He couldn't get away from his responsibility for his alleged breach of human rights. We thought, oh, this is interesting. And the fourth judge stood up, and he too declared that Pinochet had no immunity and should be arrested. And then very dramatically, the final judge stood up, Lord Hoffman, and said that Pinochet had no immunity. Eventually, the case was resolved. Pinochet was sent back on compassionate grounds by the Home Secretary, but the judges stood up one by one in the House of Lords and decided that he had no immunity. By tradition, these judges, they sat in the highest, in the upper chamber. And things had happened even before the Constitutional Reform Act that are vastly important, that political scientists in Britain know nothing about. Until 1966, the House of Lords could not overrule its judgments. They couldn't. They were bound by the decisions of the House of Lords from the 18th, 19th centuries, by the doctrine of precedent. And in 1966, scarcely anybody noticed this at the time, the House of Lords autonomously decided to give themselves the power to overrule themselves. Vastly important constitutional change. They're not tied by precedent. It was vastly important. It recognized that the courts themselves could decide that the law needed to be developed, and they could overrule their own court. So the British tradition had developed, but very few people know what's going on. Forward. Oh, that's okay. I think that's escape. Yeah. So the House of... Oops.
If you simply press...
Should we go? Then I need to go backwards. Oh, sorry. Okay. Okay. So the House of... Okay, that's easier, thanks. The House of Lords had no Marbury versus Madison power of constitutional review. And for most of its history, the House of Lords had no inclination to mix it with ministers. Judges deferred to the executive. This was especially true in relation to issues touching upon defence and security. Very famous case from 1942 called Liversidge v. Anderson. And Anderson was the name of the wartime Home Secretary. And Parliament had given him the power to arrest and detain and intern individuals who he thought had reasonable cause to believe that that individual was a person with hostile associations. Mr. Liversidge arrived in Britain from Canada, but Liversidge wasn't his real name. Nobody quite knew who he was. And for that reason alone, he was detained. And the case came before the House of Lords. Every member of the court decided in their judgment that it was good enough that the Home Secretary believed this man had hostile associations. All the Home Secretary had to do was to assert that he believed this man had hostile associations. The statute, however, used the words, had reasonable cause to believe. But the judges in the House of Lords at the time all said, if the Home Secretary says that this man has hostile associations, the court should not investigate any further. Only one judge of nine judges who gave judgment in that case dissented. Today, his judgment would probably be the judgment that the whole of the court would give. But in 1942, 70 years ago, and also during wartime, when Britain was under, in 1942, America just entered the war. Russia had been invaded, but Britain was still under threat of invasion. The courts decided that the Home Secretary, believing this man had hostile associations, was good enough to detain him. One judge dissented, and that was Lord Atkin, who became something of a hero to a later generation. He said, in England, amidst the clash of arms, the laws are not silent. They may be changed, but they speak the same language in wartime and as peace. It has always been one of the pillars of freedom, one of the principles of liberty for which on recent authority we are now fighting. The judges are no respecters of persons and stand between the subject and any attempted encroachments on his liberty by the executive, alert to see that coercive action is justified in law. He said the Home Secretary had to demonstrate that he had reasonable cause to believe this man had hostile associations. His fellow judges said, no, it's good enough for him to just simply believe that or assert it. But this ringing criticism of the executive was very, very rare. You can't make the point frequently or forcefully enough that these outpourings, these bitter attacks on ministers were exceedingly rare. Atkin was in a minority of one. In fact, as a result of his judgment and what he said, he was so critical of his fellow judges that many of his colleagues, his brother judges, refused to speak to him for the rest of his career. He was thought to have broken some taboo. Another thing about the British judiciary, the traditional British judiciary, was the curious office of the Lord Chancellor. The Lord Chancellor was the most senior judge in Britain. He acted as the head of the judiciary. He was responsible for judicial appointments and also for the appointments of Queen's Counsel for senior barristers. But he sat in the cabinet as the second most important member of cabinet. And he also sat in the House of Lords, the legislative chamber, where he acted as Speaker of the House of Lords. So he was this character who wore many hats. He was a walking, talking, judging exception to the principle of the separation of powers. He was the individual who was member of the legislature, Speaker of the House of Lords. He was member of the executive. He was the second most senior cabinet member. And he was also the most senior judge in the United Kingdom. Montesquieu would have been horrified. It's just a complete fusion of legislative, judicial, and executive powers. The potential for scandal and for bad behavior seemed to be high. Liversidge, just going back a moment, I think all these slides are slightly different. It's important to remember that Liversidge case was a wartime case, and the parallel cases in the United States. The Komatsu case in 1942 involved a case relating to the internment of people of Japanese origin in the United States. The Supreme Court, with its Marbury versus Madison powers, with its power to strike down acts of Parliament, to declare acts of presidents unconstitutional, even that court had upheld the decision to detain people of Japanese descent simply because they were of Japanese descent. I mean, imagine this happening today, post 9/11, post the Madrid bombings. Anybody of Muslim or Islamic or Pakistani or whatever descent could have been detained. So, one thing you could also say about the court in Liversidge is perhaps they weren't deferring so much to the minister, perhaps they were deferring to public opinion or recognising that public opinion was so strongly against aliens at that time that they had to defer to public opinion. So the rule of law, the idea that the court simply apply the law, was put under pressure. It's put under pressure from the executive, from ministers demanding powers, but it's also put under pressure from public opinion. The public demanding that ministers have the power to detain whoever they want in times of external threat. So the traditional system was full of anomalies. Judges were led by a partisan politician. Lord Hailsham, who was the Lord Chancellor under Mrs. Thatcher, was a man who probably ought to have become leader of the Conservative Party in the early 1960s. A man who was incredibly involved in the Conservative Party. But he became the Lord Chancellor, the most senior judge, and Speaker of the House of Lords. Judges were appointed by the Queen on advice of the Prime Minister and Lord Chancellor. So were Queen's Counsels. This man, the Lord Chancellor, had vast power. Judges could be called upon to interpret legislation that they debated and had voted on in the House of Lords. They were acting as legislature and judiciary. What about the separation of powers? But there was never, never, never in Britain any serious claims of corruption or calls for reform. Some on the left worried that judges would block Labour and socialist legislation. That wasn't the case. The judges did not prevent a great deal of the post-war legislation getting through. And it was here where British constitutional experts would smile and pause and congratulate themselves and say it was a very British solution. You have a situation, a clear breach of the idea of the separation of powers, but it worked. And we're British, and we do whatever works. We don't have these nonsense theory about the separation of powers and the need for checks and balances. The British system worked. And they could also say, even where there are strong checks and balances, as in the US system, in the Komatsu case, there were no more protection for minorities in the United States than there had been in Britain. In effect, that Britain's liberties were just as well protected as the Supreme Court in the United States. We go forward, that was a traditional situation, to New Labour. New Labour came to power in 1997, and they had an agreed agenda for constitutional reform with the Liberal Democrats. Reform of the House of Lords as a legislature was always on the agenda. The majority of the members of the House of Lords in 1997 were hereditary peers who were there by virtue of their birth. And the New Labour government and Liberal Democrats agreed to get rid of these individuals. So the only people who would be members of the House of Lords would be appointed by the Prime Ministers and the leaders of the other parties in future. They agreed on that. But at the time, no one gave any serious consideration to reform of the appellate committee of the House of Lords. The hereditary peers left Parliament, most of them. The judges stayed, and then the new House of Lords legislature consisted of people who were appointed by the Prime Minister or the leader of the opposition. The irony is that actually the hereditary peers, they weren't all got rid of. It was decided, in order to make sure that the reform took place, that 100 of the hereditary peers would be elected by their fellow hereditary peers to be members of the House of Lords. So you have a wonderful paradox that the only elected members of the House of Lords at the present time are hereditary peers, who are elected by their fellow hereditary peers. When one dies, there's a by-election, and they elect another person to replace them. But they're the only elected members of the House of Lords at the moment. But reform of the court, the House of Lords as a court, was never on the radar at all. Not until an accident occurred. There were some long-term causes of reform, and some of them we've alluded to already. There were some long-term causes. One was outlined by Lord Bingham, who was the senior law lord in 2002, at a speech he gave at the Constitution Unit in London in 2002. He said, basically, the House of Lords is such an anomaly. Judges sitting in the legislature, debating the principles, voting on the legislation. It's such an anomaly that we ought to address it. And that, I think one of the factors causing people to question this situation was the growth of comparative legal studies. Judges in Britain used to be very parochial. They used to look at British case law. In the post-war period, increasingly they became aware of different constitutional possibilities. They were aware that in other similar countries, such as the United States and Canada and Australia, particularly Commonwealth countries, there were different constitutional setups. And they were influenced by that. They appreciated the logic underlying those constitutions. There was also a line of European court cases insisting on a clear separation of powers. From the 1950s, Britain had been a member signatory to the European Convention. And there was a long line of cases in the European Court insisting that people who had voted on the law, had debated law and voted on it, weren't called to act as a judge, judging the legality of that law in the future. And the court made it very clear that it wasn't simply the case that there was no wrongdoing. You didn't have to demonstrate there was no wrongdoing. You had to make clear to everybody that there was no ability for any wrongdoing. So appearances mattered. If you were an individual who were before a court being prosecuted under a law, and the judge who was sitting in front of you had actually debated and passed the law that you were now being prosecuted under, you'd be worried about that. You'd think there'd be an abuse of power here. And also, I think this was the weakest claim that Lord Bingham made for the reason to change the situation was public opinion, that the public were unnerved and worried about judicial independence. There's no evidence of this at all. In trust, in issues relating to trust, Ipsos Mori regularly asks people what's the most trustworthy profession. And judges are right up there with doctors as the most trusted profession in Britain. Why people trust doctors has always been a mystery to me, but they do. So there was no call for public opinion, really, to reform. But there was a short-term reason to reform. And the short-term reason was very political. Tony Blair was then Prime Minister. His Lord Chancellor was a man called Lord Irvine. Lord Irvine was a very, how can I put it, pompous, self-important man. He had been Tony Blair's boss when Tony Blair was a trainee barrister. He was being the head of Tony Blair's chambers. And he became an advisor to Tony Blair, very powerful, very influential man. But over time, relations between the two men had deteriorated. And in 2003, rather than simply sack his Lord Chancellor, he decided, because he was, I think, fairly weak in this regard, he decided to pretend that he wasn't really sacking Lord Irvine, his former boss. He was abolishing the post of Lord Chancellor. He was doing what everybody thought should have been done, which was to separate the judicial and the legislative and the executive functions. And he announced that the post of Lord Chancellor would be abolished. This provoked howls of protest from the judiciary and from lawyers. I think the term I have in mind, you probably understand, it was a hissy fit. Judges got really angry about this. They were annoyed that Tony Blair had abolished the ancient institution of Lord Chancellor just simply because he wasn't brave enough to tell Lord Irvine that he'd been sacked. And as a result of this, as a result of judicial opposition, the new Lord Chancellor, who was Tony Blair's former flatmate, Lord Falconer, got together with the judges and they agreed a programme of reform. They wrote out a concordat together. It was a mess. It was a complete mess. It was an accident. There were good reasons to abolish the Lord Chancellor and to reform the courts. But the way it came about was a messy, political, personal reasons. So they got together and they agreed a reform. And the Constitution, that produced the Constitutional Reform Act, which created the new Supreme Court. It introduced a new system of judicial appointment, which gave the Lord Chancellor much less role, called the Judicial Appointments Commission. It stated that the Act in no way changed the rule of law. It reformed the office of Lord Chancellor. He was no longer the Speaker of the House of Lords. That was a new position. He was no longer the head of the judiciary. Now, the head of the British judiciary is the Lord Chief Justice, which is odd, really, because the Lord Chief Justice sits in the Court of Appeal, which is below the new Supreme Court. Nevertheless, he is now the head of the judiciary. And the Lord Chancellor was given responsibility for simply running the courts and ensuring the independence of the judiciary. So we have the new Supreme Court created with the new impressive and thoroughly misleading title. Judges no longer sat in the House of Lords. They were called Justices of the Supreme Court. And all the members, former members of the House of Lords in October 2008, in November 2009, October 2009, in November 2009, became Justices of the Supreme Court. Lord Chief Justice, head of judiciary, the senior law lord became president of the Supreme Court, and they acquired a new building. They no longer worked in Parliament. They no longer gave their judgments in the chamber of the upper house. They got a new building called the Middlesex Guildhall, very impressive building, not far from Parliament. It acquired a new secretariat, and I think this is significant, it included a significant press relations office. The new Supreme Court acquired a bureaucracy of its own and a significant press office. Why should a court have a press office? We'll come back to that later. It acquired its new website. It's got a great website. It tells you what judges are before the court now. It sets out all the judgments. It tells you little biographies of the judges so you know where they went to university, what sports they play. Lord Kerr is very keen on tennis. Baroness Hale spends her time in Yorkshire at the weekends enjoying cooking. We know all about these people in a way we never knew before. But in every other respect, the new Supreme Court was the same as the House of Lords. So not very important then. Actually, the new institution is very important because, as I said earlier, the House of Lords, the institution it replaced, had become tremendously powerful and important actor in British politics. British judges have not moved, if they're not really moved up front and centre, they're not central to the political process in the way the justices of the Supreme Court are, but they have moved towards the centre of British politics in the post-war period. The odd thing is that most Britons are unaware of this. They're only intermittently aware of it. And there have been there have been factors increasing judicial power before the creation of this new court. One is that they've continued to develop the new common law, expanded the judicial review. They've also come out in a way that I'll explain in a moment. And there's also been Britain's membership of Europe and also the Human Rights Act, which have changed things. This, I think, is tremendously important. One of the reasons that judges have become powerful is that they've continued to develop the common law. It's an important part of the mythology of the British legal system that judges don't make law. They declare what the law is. They apply precedent. They don't innovate. They simply decide cases before them according to precedent. So it maintains the mythology that they have really no discretion, that they're bound by precedent and hierarchy. They're not really powerful figures. They're not making personal choices. And in any way, and this is still true, Parliament can always overturn judicial lawmaking if they don't like it. And that act of Parliament would be supreme. But no one believes in that fairy tale anymore for lots of reasons. Some judges have come clean. Some of them have actually said, hands up, yeah, we make the law. Lord Denning in the 1960s proclaimed that judges must make the law to deliver justice because Parliament acted too slowly. There was a need for justice, there was a need for an act, there was a need for reform, but Parliament would take time, they would debate matters, they would issue white papers, and by the time they came to act, if they did come to act, the little old lady with the grievance would be dead. So Denning insisted that judges must act. Lord Reed, who became a law lord, said the idea that judges didn't make the law was a fairy tale. Most judges wish that these judges had kept quiet because they know that's the case. Judges make law every day. They have to. Even when Parliament drafts legislation, there are holes, there are questions about interpretation, and most of the laws that influence Britons in their daily lives are based on the common law. Contract law in Britain is purely common law. There's very little legislation. Most criminal law in Britain is common law. The law of torts, negligence, the ability to sue somebody when you're involved in a car accident, is entirely based on case law. Judges have always had that power. They've continued to develop those common law rules. The second reason that judges had acquired more power before the Constitutional Reform Act was they extended judicial review. Judges cannot declare acts of Parliament unconstitutional, full stop. But they can declare the actions of ministers and of local authorities and of public authorities illegal on several grounds. Ministers in the post-war period were often given powers, discretionary powers. That's particularly in relation to the welfare state, decisions about granting benefits to people, decisions about asylum. They were given powers, they had discretionary powers. And the courts have moved to control those powers. So there are three principles that the courts have applied in developing judicial review. One is a very simple principle of ultra vires. If a minister has acted and he cannot point to a statute to justify his action, he has acted ultra vires. If a local authority has done something and it can't point to a statute giving it power, it has acted ultra vires. It's illegal, null. The second way in which judicial review was expanded was by expanding the principles of natural justice. As I said, many of the institutions that were created in the post-war period gave bureaucrats and ministers this quasi-judicial power, a discretionary power to allocate a benefit here, take away a benefit, grant somebody the right of asylum here, grant the right of asylum there. These are quasi-judicial powers, and the courts have insisted that if a minister makes a decision, he or a bureaucrat makes a decision, they apply the rules that, or give people the same benefits they would have had if they'd have been in court. They have a right to a fair hearing. They have a right to know what they're accused of. They have a right to know the basis of the action. And the third factor, expanding judicial review, has been the most controversial. This has been developed by the lower courts, hesitantly. Often, it's been used to block ministerial decisions. Proportionality. The courts have insisted that if a minister acts or a local authority acts, that its actions are proportional. And this is controversial because it seems as if the judge is replacing their own judgment, the minister's judgment or the local authority's judgment, with their own. But the courts have developed the principles of judicial review, and that's brought them into conflict with ministers over penal policy. Historically, Home Secretaries, a minister of in the executive, has had the power to decide how long a life sentence should be. So a politician who is responsive to public opinion, who is sensitive to political pressure, has made the ultimate decision about when prisoners were released. The courts hated that, and eventually they decided it was illegal, it was unconstitutional, it was incompatible with the European Convention. They have resisted attempts by ministers to interfere in their sentencing policy. And when ministers wrote clauses in Acts of Parliament insisting that the courts, that the decision of the minister will not be contested in any court, when they, even when they've put that into the legislation, the courts have rejected the ouster clause. The case here was called Anismenik, and it said the decision of the minister in this case, in any case, shall be final and not challengeable in any court. Seems clear, doesn't it? Judges have no say. The judges rejected the ouster clause. They said, well, of course, that's what the legislation says, that's what Parliament says. But it's still for the courts to decide whether or not the minister's decision was really a decision at all. It's the inherent jurisdiction of the courts. The minister could not oust the jurisdiction of a court. Yes, you're saying your decision cannot be challenged in any courts, but the court can still decide whether or not your decision is really a decision. And the characteristics of the decision is that somebody has informed themselves, they've applied the principles of natural justice, and if your decision falls short of those standards, it is illegal. Another change that occurred before the Constitutional Reform Act was that the judges started to change their behaviour. I said before that judges tended to defer to the executive. In the Liversidge and Anderson case, it was good enough for the Home Secretary to say this man had hostile associations, even though the statute said he ought to have reasonable cause to believe. Increasingly, the judges have changed in their temperament. They're not willing to defer to the executive quite so much. Until the late 1980s, the judges didn't say much about what they were doing outside the courts. There was something called the Kilmuir Rules, which meant that judges, once they gave judgment in a court, wouldn't write papers explaining their decisions any further. They wouldn't give lectures explaining their theories of the development of the law. They would simply give their judgments in the court, and that would be it. And that helped them maintain the mystique of the judges. They were like gods coming down from Olympus giving their judgment. We didn't know very much about judges at all. But sometimes they appeared remote. In the early 1960s, somebody mentioned the Beatles in a court case. And one of the judges caused much hilarity by asking the question, who are the Beatles? It was so remote, so cut off. These were the most famous four men on the planet. And the judge was remote, didn't understand them. So they had no real functions outside the court and their judgments. In the early 1980s, people started to question this, and in 1988, the Kilmuir Rules, the rules restricting their ability to give lectures, to explain what they're about, to give interviews to the media, were abolished by a conservative Lord Chancellor, Lord Mackay of Clashfern. And he was a very conservative Chancellor, but he abolished the rules. He thought that judges should explain what they were about. They should give lectures. They could be able to write think pieces. And they didn't defend their parochial interests. They started to develop theories about the law. They said, we must learn from jurisdictions. We're not just simply about applying the law. We need to think about how the law should be developed in the future. And some of them, in their judgments, started to portray themselves not as judges, but as guardians of liberty, custodians of the Constitution. The intellectual zeitgeist changed. Amongst the judges and lawyers, there was all talk about fundamental human rights. And this seeped into the British judiciary. And all these changes occurred as a result of changes brought about by the judges themselves. These were decisions of the judges, changes in their behaviour. And then we get Britain joining Europe in 1972. Section 2(1) of the European Communities Act made the UK law subject to EU law. So the European Court of Justice is the final court in relation to all matters of European law. This seemed like a simple breach of the principle of parliamentary sovereignty. In the past, we were told Parliament couldn't bind its successor. So if Parliament legislated in 1988 to stop Spanish fishermen registering their boats in England and getting British quotas, that was good English law. And that ought to have overturned Section 2(1) of the European Communities Act. The judges decided that it didn't, that the European Communities Act was entrenched in the Constitution. If Parliament did make it very clear that they were aware that this legislation breached European law, and they made it very clear in legislation, the judges would still defer to Parliament. And Parliament could always decide to leave the European law, European Union. But until that, European law would take precedent over British law. Let me go back. The Factor Tame case. This is Spanish fishermen. This is the Spanish fishermen case. Legislation in late 1989 was introduced to stop Spanish fishermen, rascals as they were, buying English ships or registering Spanish ships as English ships and taking the British fish quota. This case went to the European Court, and it also went through the House of Lords, and this was the case that made it clear that European law trumped UK law. So I just get in the bit about Spanish fishermen for Agusti. The other change that occurred, and this was vastly important, was the Human Rights Act of 1998. The United Kingdom became signatories to the European Convention on Human Rights in the 1950s. But until the early 1960s, Britons didn't have the right to take their cases to the court at Strasbourg. In the early 1960s, the courts, they were given the right to take their case directly to Strasbourg. And what the Human Rights Act did was to incorporate the European Convention into UK law. Formally, this was done by preserving parliamentary sovereignty in a very strange way that I'll explain in a moment. But what it did was introduce standards against which all legislation could be judged. The European Convention sets out certain fundamental human rights. And if legislation in the future appears to breach those conventions, then there are certain things that happen. The Human Rights Act, in effect, has changed the UK standing understanding of the rule of law, and it implies that there are real limits on parliamentary sovereignty. Formally, the relationship between the executive and courts is unchanged. What happens is that every time a minister brings an act before Parliament, it contains a statement to the effect that the minister believes that this act is compatible with the European Convention. Then, if the legislation becomes law, and it is challenged, the courts cannot declare the Act of Parliament unconstitutional. What they do is they say, they're instructed by Parliament, the Human Rights Act, if possible, to interpret every bit of legislation passed before the Human Rights Act and after the Human Rights Act as if it were compatible with the European Convention on Human Rights. So judges have been instructed by Parliament to try, if possible, to interpret legislation as if it were compatible with convention rights. If they cannot interpret legislation as if it were compatible with convention rights, they have no power to declare it unconstitutional. But what they do is issue something called a declaration of incompatibility. They say to Parliament, you appear to have legislated in breach of the European Convention. Would you like to consider revising or reforming the legislation? It's not an instruction, it's not a command. It's saying to Parliament, in 1998 you told us to interpret legislation as if it were compatible with convention rights. We can't do it in this case. So perhaps you ought to think about rewriting legislation. The most dramatic illustration of the power of the Human Rights Act is thought to be these declarations of incompatibility, because they're very public statements. They appear to be the judges saying, Parliament, you seem to have got it wrong. Would you like to think again? That's partly true. But I think actually what's more interesting about the Human Rights Act is not the declaration of incompatibility. It is the instruction to the judges to try to interpret legislation as if it were compatible with the European Convention, if it's possible. The problem is, what does it mean to say, if it's possible to do so? Judges are presented with an act, and it uses the word black. And that makes the word, the act, incompatible with the convention. Can the judges interpret the legislation as if the word said, not black, but black and white? Can they add a word in to the legislation? What is the limits of what is possible to do? How can the judges stretch the interpretation? There was a case in point, was Guyden versus Mendoza. This related to the granting of tenancies to council tenants. And in 1977, an act was passed which said, if I, as a local authority, grant a tenancy to Auguste Bosch, and he dies, his rights as a tenant will pass to his spouse. Okay? Very simple. And then in 1980, that act was revised in order to reflect the fact that many people live together happily in a family unit but don't get married. And the act was revised to read, if Auguste Bosch dies, the woman who is living as his wife, she will get the tenancy. And the question came before the court in Guyden versus Mendoza, what happens where it's a gay couple? Can we read living as husband and wife as living as, you know, happy couple? And all the judges in the case, except one, said, well, we've got to see that times have moved on. It's perfectly possible for people to have happy, viable family units, living as homosexuals rather than heterosexuals. Therefore, we will read this legislation so that Mr. Guy Dan will get the rights that he would have had had his partner, who had the tenancy, he will get those rights. One judge disagreed. He was Lord Millett. Lord Millett was a commercial judge, and he had a conservative interpretation of the power of court. He said, there is bound to be a temptation to apply this section beyond its proper scope and trespass upon the prerogative of Parliament in what will almost be invariably be a good case. So he was worried that the courts would stretch the interpretation of legislation. They would move ahead of Parliament. It wasn't possible to interpret living as husband and wife as meaning living as a gay couple, according to Millett. The other four judges in the case thought it was. So there's controversy here. The really important part of the Human Rights Act is that power. If it's possible to do so, to interpret legislation, because they can go back every legislative piece of legislation before the Act and after the Act is subject to this standard. If there's been a declaration of incompatibility, there is a provision for ministers to fast-track legislation to remedy the defect. So there is a provision in Parliament for Parliament to take the reform through very quickly. If ministers decide to say, well, the Supreme Court has declared this incompatible with conventional rights, we are not going to introduce fast-track legislation, then what would happen is that the ministers would know that the case would probably be challenged in the court at Strasbourg. They'd be challenged in the courts, and because the Supreme Court thinks that they're in breach of convention, it's virtually certain that the European Court in Strasbourg will think they're in breach. Then they'll be in breach of their treaty obligations. That'll be very embarrassing for the government. The Human Rights Act came into force in October 2000. Think about the timing. October 2000, the Human Rights Act comes into force. Within a year, we have 9/11. Within 4 years, we have the Madrid bombings and what became the 7/7 bombings in London. And the Labour government introduced all sorts of draconian powers to detain, without trial and without bringing people before the courts, individuals they suspected of being terrorists. In the right-wing press, and most of the press in Britain is pretty right-wing, the Human Rights Act was portrayed as protecting minorities, unpopular minorities, terrorists, criminals, foreigners, immigrants, gays. So a lot of the right-wing press attacked the Human Rights Act. Recently we have Theresa May, who is the Home Secretary, telling the Conservative Conference that the Human Rights Act, a judge had decided that somebody could not be deported from the UK because it would be cruel to his pet cat. This was completely untrue. It was a lie. It's completely untrue. And the Lord Chancellor, Kenneth Clark, told the Home Secretary off. The new Lord Chancellor is given the responsibility for protecting judges, for preserving the rule of law. And he criticised Theresa May for making that observation. But the Human Rights Act has become associated with protecting minorities, which, of course, is exactly its purpose. Protecting minorities within a democracy. The Human Rights Act affects the interpretation of all legislation, both pre and post-1998. And some advocates of human rights, it must be said, have been disappointed with how the judges have interpreted the Human Rights Act. On occasion, they've acted quite conservatively. They've disappointed people who've advocated human rights. In those cases, of course, cases can always be taken to the European Court at Strasbourg. 11 years, of course, is a very short time to judge just how significant an influence the Human Rights Act is having on the law. The effect of the Human Rights Act is complex, cumulative, and very difficult to trace through, but it's having, clearly, a profound effect. The Human Rights Act, the idea that people have certain inalienable rights, is being woven through the fabric of the United Kingdom's legal system. The idea is gaining ground. Judges are becoming familiar with the idea that people have fundamental human rights. This is an interesting observation from Lord Hoffman. I'll tell you something about Lord Hoffman. Lord Hoffman is one of those judges who decided that Pinochet, the dictator from Chile, did not have legal immunity. His decision in that case caused an uproar because his wife was a member, as a chairperson, of an organization called Amnesty International, one of the committees. Amnesty International actually became a party to the Pinochet case and argued that he should be arrested. And the fact that his wife was a chairman of a charity associated with Amnesty meant that Lord Hoffman should not have sat and given judgment in that case. In a panic, what happened a few months later, it was appealed, and the court had to be reconvened again without Lord Hoffman. They had to draft in retired law lords to give judgment in the case, and they again decided that Pinochet did not have immunity. But Lord Hoffman was a man under pressure. He was a man who was feeling very unhappy with the executive. And in a case that related to deciding whether a power to detain terrorist suspects without trial, without bringing them before the court for 60 days, was legal, Lord Hoffman said as follows. It's very similar to what Lord Atkin said in 1942. I said the power of detention is at present confined to foreigners, and I would not like to give the impression that all the necessary was to extend the power to United Kingdom citizens to detain citizens in the UK as well. What the Act did, it was declared incompatible with convention rights because it gave the Home Secretary the power to detain foreign nationals, not UK nationals. And therefore, it was decided that it discriminated. And Hoffman here is saying, even if the Act had given the Minister the power to detain UK nationals and non-UK nationals, he would still have found it illegal and incompatible with convention rights. He said, in my opinion, such a power in any form is not compatible with our constitution. The real threat to the life of the nation, in the sense of a people living in accordance with its traditional laws and political values, comes not from terrorism, but from laws such as these. That is the true measure of what terrorism may achieve. It is for Parliament to decide whether to give terrorists such a victory. This is Lord Atkin. This is the voice of Lord Atkin, 1942. Come forward to 2004. Vitriolic attack on the government and on Parliament. So there are continuing tensions between the rule of law and parliamentary sovereignty. I'll briefly mention the case of Jackson. Jackson was a case about hunting with dogs. The people who wanted to keep hunting with dogs made an argument saying that the act was illegal because it had been taken through using a procedure called the Parliament Act 1949, and they said that the Parliament Act 1949 was itself illegal. On the larger argument, the judges rejected this argument in its entirety. They appeared to side with the Labour government and with Parliament. But then, in their judgments, they started to say some very odd things, things that British judges have not traditionally said. Lord Hope, who is the Deputy President of the Supreme Court, has said, step by step, gradually but surely, the English principle of the absolute legislative sovereignty of Parliament, which was derived from Cook and Blackstone, is being qualified. The fact that your lordships have been willing to hear this appeal and to give judgment upon it is another indication that the courts have a part to play in defining the limits of parliamentary sovereignty. That's a very strange thing to say. The Human Rights Act was introduced preserving parliamentary sovereignty formally. But here is a judge actually qualifying it. The principle of parliamentary sovereignty, which in the absence of high authority has been created by the common law, is built upon the assumption that Parliament represents the people to whom it exists to serve. Again, something very odd. It seems to be suggesting it's not based on the Human Rights Act, this judgment. He's discerning within the English common law tradition, he's trying to formulate the idea that the courts may have the power, in extremis, to declare acts of Parliament unconstitutional. And he's not basing his judgment on European law or the Human Rights Act. This is really interesting. And Lord Steyne, another senior law lord, says much the same. He says, parliamentary sovereignty is a construct of the common law. The judges in the past have decided to defer to Parliament, but perhaps in the future it needn't do so. So, conclusions. The Supreme Court in the UK is not supreme in the US sense. It doesn't have the power of constitutional review. It can't declare valid acts of the Parliament unconstitutional. But the British courts, led by the House of Lords, has already acquired a lot more power. The new institution itself, I think, has done little so far to alter the things. But the new court, I think, has, and this is very interesting, something I mentioned earlier on, has made great efforts to explain what it's about to the public. It opened itself up. It has a website where people, members of the public, can go and read judgments, or executive summary of judgments if they don't want to read the full 80-page summary judgments that trained lawyers have to read. They have hired communications experts and people, specialists on public relations. They've allowed television to make 3 documentaries following the judges round as they hear the cases, as they decide the cases. You've even seen judges in the corridor talking about cases to each other. You've seen judges sitting down at their dining table, writing out in the ink pen their judgment. All sorts of things opened up the court. They seem to acknowledge that public opinion is the big resource in a democracy, and that they need to keep the public opinion on side. In particular, they need to correct some of the misinformation that gets out there from the press, particularly the right-wing press, which has been fairly hostile to the Human Rights Act in particular. In the future, we now have a Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition. The Conservatives would like to place the Human Rights Act with something called a British Human Rights Act. This is causing a lot of puzzlement amongst professional lawyers, because the Conservative Party is not advocating British withdrawal from the European Convention on Human Rights. So in what way would the British Human Rights Act differ from the Human Rights Act? I must admit, I'm not sure about that. There's been no suggestion of withdrawal from the European Convention on Human Rights, and there's still a fantasy about renegotiating the treaty. But how can you change the European Convention on Human Rights? You need to get all the signatories to agree to a change. It's not going to happen. It's very unclear what the difference between the British Human Rights Act and the Human Rights Act itself would be. By implication, there's an idea that it would be less generous to unpopular minorities, such as criminals, asylum seekers, Spanish fishermen, that sort of thing. Who knows? Looking to the future, I think one of the important changes in the court has been a cultural change. The judges have started to become very familiar with using the language of fundamental human rights. And as you saw in the judgments of Lord Steyne, Lord Hoffman, Lord Hope, they don't cite the European Convention. They don't claim that as authority. They discern in the common law itself, going back to cases decided in 1376 or 1548, within the common law, a tradition would justify judges in the future perhaps declaring acts of Parliament unconstitutional. And I think that's interesting. The new generation of judges There's been a generational change in judges. The judges who became the most senior judges in when the Human Rights Act came into force were people who were brought up on the British tradition. And they were quite conservative in their approach. Lord Hope, who's clearly a very nice man, one of my students about 6 years ago did her dissertation on the rule of law under pressure in the UK. And Lord Hope sent her a 12-page email. He apologised. In his first paragraph, he said, "I'm sorry for being unable to reply to your interesting email, but my secretary has been ill, so I'm typing this myself." And in his email to this student, he explained that as a trainee barrister, he had no knowledge at all about human rights. The language of human rights was alien to him. It seemed to be due entirely with political theory and politics, not something he was familiar with. And he explained in this really interesting, quite touching sort of how he started to learn about human rights. The new judges who come through in the future will be people who will be imbued with this language, this new language of human rights. And I think in future they might give much more radical judgments in future which challenge the power of court and possibly even Parliament itself. So I'll leave it there. I'm sorry, I've probably gone on for a long time. It's very interesting what's happening in the courts. Outside of a few law departments in Britain, very few people are, I think, aware of these changes. But they are quite profound.